Reality Break Podcast, Episode 8, with William Shun. Let me catch my breath, quit bugging me to death. The check is in the mail, I'll find you holding bail. But first, let me take a reality break. I need to take a reality break. Bandwidth for Reality Break is provided by CashFly. Hello and welcome to the Reality Break podcast. I'm your host, Dave Slusher. This episode, we have an interview with author and podcaster William Shun. He's the author of many science fiction stories, including the Hugo and Nebula-nominated novella Inclination. Later this year, his book Cast a Cold Eye, a collaboration with Daryl Murphy, will be published. This interview is one that was recorded some time ago when he was originally podcasting his unpublished memoir, The Accidental Terrorist. Luckily for me, this has become timely and relevant again as he's republishing an edited version of that memoir. It will appear in both original form as well as an edited form without any introductions to be experienced solely as an audiobook. I highly recommend this memoir in any format you prefer. And now, here's our interview with author William Shun. Now, I've done a lot of these interviews, and the traditional first question is, tell me about your book. Now, as I'm doing one of the first interviews of this new era of the show, I'm going to ask a first question I've never asked before, which is, tell me about the book you're serializing via your podcast.
Okay. This is a book that I've been working on in one form or another for, it's 14 years now. It's a memoir recounting my experiences as a Mormon missionary in Canada, and particularly the events leading up to my arrest and subsequent deportation on charges related to terrorism. And originally, I had always wanted to write a book about my experiences as a missionary. It was difficult to do while I was still a faithful member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, because I would have to go into a lot of details about missionary life that would probably make members of my church uncomfortable, that I was uncomfortable talking about while I was still a Mormon. But after I left the church, that, you know, those misgivings went away. I've done various drafts of the book, one which, a very early one, was just me posting bits about my experiences back on Genie, back in the days when there were just text bulletin boards and so forth on the internet, before there was really much of a web yet. Around 1999, I got really serious about taking that, which I had also subsequently posted on my website, and turning it into a full-blown memoir. That memoir has gone through various drafts, and we're trying hard to sell it in various places, but people have been clamoring so much to hear the story, the longer version of the story, that eventually I decided maybe I could generate a little bit more publicity for it by reading it serialized in my podcast. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing that since last March 2006, a chapter every 2 weeks, and we're getting pretty close to the end of the book now. And the audience response has been pretty good. People seem to be enjoying it and hanging on the cliffhangers every other week.
Now, I'm firmly in that camp because I was active on Genie along with you, and I've been interested in reading the book for a decade. So, when you started doing the podcast, I was happy because I had been interested in this kind of, you know, vaporware book that I had been hoping would come out for, 10 years or more. So, I'm probably the most committed member of that audience that you could be.
I'm very glad to hear that. I appreciate it, and that's the whole reason I've kept plugging at the book as long as I have. It's been a difficult sell. I'm convinced we'll sell it eventually. There are some interesting nibbles at the moment, although nothing that's definite yet. But we were getting close, I think, around 2001, and then September 11th came along, and that just knocked the possibility of doing anything related to terrorism right out of the water for a while. But now I'm working on a new I'm honing actually the draft that I've read in the memoir, and that's probably not exactly what will eventually be published. But it's pretty close. I think the book is just about there.
So now you mentioned September 11th, which is you sort of can't talk about a book like this without, you know, evoking it and kind of mentioning it and it being at the forefront. Now, you had already worked on the book for, you know, 10 years at that point. Does the last 5-6 years of the work on the book post that, I mean, do you write differently knowing that people are now bringing different baggage to particularly the portion where, you know, where you discuss your own, you know, obviously what you did was nowhere near. It was pretty mild in the, you know, in the world of what could be considered terrorism. But
but
now it's a much more fraught subject and word.
I have to admit, I have not changed my approach much in light of that. What I have done, and what this is part of the book that I'm still working on, trying to compose an epilogue that addresses a little bit of that and ties in what I did in Calgary, which was very, very minor, with September 11th a little bit and what I did that day. Because I live in New York City, and on September 11th, as my wife and I were riveted to the television watching what was going on, I got some emails from friends who had started circulating lists of people who were okay, who they had heard from, and asked us to add our names, pass on the list to other people that we knew. And I decided at that point to just create a little website where people could post their own names. You know, I was just thinking friends of ours, so that there was one place people could go to see that their friends were okay. And this started out as just a little circle of mainly science fiction people. Teresa Nielsen Hayden gave me the idea, but then it took off from there. And before the end of the day, there were thousands of postings on my website, and I'd brought my web host servers down to their knees. So I still haven't worked out exactly how that is going to fit into the book in the epilogue, but I want to address it and try to show at least a little bit there at the end that I understand how different the world is now, and that I'm not trying to really make light of terrorism in this book.
Now, kind of concurrent with the whole time you've been working on this book, you've been a working publishing science fiction author.
Yes.
So in some ways, does the fictional chops that you have been honing this whole time, does it add to the skills as a memoirist? Does it bring things you have to avoid as a memoirist? You know, memoir having kind of gotten a black eye in, say, the last year, you know, you go well out of your way to point out everything that you've tarted up in your podcast version of this. You know, so do you have to kind of fight the urge to sex it up as you're writing or as you're revising?
Well, I think that honing my fictional skills have definitely contributed a lot to the memoir. A memoir is a much closer cousin to a novel than a lot of people probably want to think. It's a book form, a form of writing that takes specifically the author's memories and tries to turn them into a comprehensible story, one that can be riveting to the reader. And because of the very nature of the form, you have to take liberties with the truth, with what really happened. I mean, if there's a particular point that's very important for someone to understand about your life, but there's a conversation maybe that didn't really happen in real life that would illuminate that point, you're hard-pressed not to invent that conversation to try to explain this important point of the story. And I don't think that's out of bounds. It's if you ride that slope down a little farther and start inventing whole events or making things up for the sake of making them up, that you start to get into trouble. And you really do, as a memoirist, have to bring the skill of a novelist or a fiction writer to what you're doing, because it's very, very close to fiction.
Well, like, for example, some of the things that you mentioned that you do are, you collapse maybe a number of conversations that happened over the course of months
right.
into a single conversation, which, you if you did the literal truth, would actually, for the reader's experience as reading it, would diminish it. But, you know, by putting it into the form that you did, you give them something closer to the experience. You know, it's not literally true, but it's more conceptually true.
Right. It's more, it gets closer to the essence of what all those conversations were about. If you sat and literally transcribed a conversation that a couple of people were having, even this one we're having now, it wouldn't read necessarily as something that flowed easily and was compelling on the page. Not to mention that unless you had a tape recorder while you were living your life, you would never be able to reproduce those conversations exactly as they occurred. You have to pick and choose carefully from what elements you have in the material available to you, which ones are the most critical to your story, and you know, rearrange them a little bit, punch up the ones that are the most germane to the point that you need to make. It's a real art, and it's a balancing act. I went through a lot of angst working on the book, trying to figure out exactly how far was far enough or too far to push what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And well, and it's hard. It seems like that's not very different from what the best of science fiction can accomplish. The notion of, you know, a small embellishment getting to the heart of a greater truth. In a large portion, you know, the science fiction, when it's really clicking on all, you know, when it's hitting on all cylinders, is using made up things to really expose the essence of what our current present day life is about.
Exactly. And I like to think that not just having worked as a fiction writer, but specifically as a science fiction writer, has helped me with this particular memoir also, because we're not just trying to get at illuminating a particular truth about my life, but I'm also trying to explicate a culture that is alien to probably the majority of the people who are going to read this book. There's a lot of world building to be done in a memoir like this.
So let's explicitly talk a little bit about Mormonism, not so much the religion itself, but to me, you know, of the definitely of the Christian religions, it seems most fantastical and science fictional in that, you know, traditional Christianity is distant, you know, it's distant physically, geographically, but it's also distant in time. And Mormonism is, as far as I know, the only Christian religion that has miracles happening on U.S. soil, you know, roughly, the time of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Civil War and earlier. The church was founded in, 1830. That was when the church was actually organized. Everything kicked off supposedly in 1820 when Joseph Smith saw a vision of, not a vision really, but was actually visited by God and Jesus Christ, who he described as two separate people who had bodies of flesh and bone and were completely physical, as opposed to some of the other Christian conceptions of God. It's interesting that what kicked off the whole Mormon religion, in a way you could maybe compare it to Dianetics even, was a book that was written by a gifted storyteller. And I think that Joseph Smith was really a gifted fantasy writer. He was a boy who had grown up telling stories to his family, making up stories about all the strange Indian mounds that could be found all over the landscape in upstate New York, where he and his family lived. And he would spin out these tales. His mother writes in her memoir about Joseph making up stories about these great former Native nations and the wars that they had, and so forth. When he got to be a little older, He became known as a bit of a treasure hunter. He and his father would hire out to folks to do dowsing and use peepstones to find the location where supposedly buried treasure was hidden. And in fact, they were taken to court because they were accused of fraud. But all these things came together when Joseph was in his early 20s, and he began the work of what he would say was translating these gold plates that an angel showed him that had engravings on them from early inhabitants of America. And of course, the way that I and a lot of other ex-Mormons would interpret it is that Joseph was making up a story. And he wrote a whole book that chronicled 1,000 years of the culture of the Native Americans of that time, and all their miracles, all their prophecies, all their wars, from the time they sailed boats from Jerusalem to America to the time 1,000 years later when one of the nations was completely wiped out. And he called it historical fact and published the book, got a lot of followers, and the Mormon religion was born and burgeoned.
So it seems almost like had the same man come along a little later and there were, there was a structure for it, he might have become a working writer. You know, he might have gone the Poe route.
He might have. I'm not sure if he had the discipline to stick to writing every day. He was an immensely charismatic individual, and he wrote the Book of Mormon in under a year in a great burst of creativity, and he was often dictating it to a lot of other folks. But if he had been able to harness that energy and discipline it, yeah, he could have been one of those immensely successful pot boiling writers of the time. He could have been the H. Rider Haggard of America or something.
Now you grew up in this tradition. And, even as a teenager, you were interested in writing and you kind of went towards that goal. Do you see any pathway from that, that tradition and being steeped kind of in this, American mythos, towards where you ultimately, decided to pursue your craft?
Absolutely. The Mormon religion really does teach you to think about the world as a place of immense awesomeness and mystery, but one that ultimately makes sense, and that was crafted deliberately and with some kind of logical plan. The Mormon creation myth, for instance, taken on its own terms, is very logical as far as internal consistency goes. And it doesn't make a lot of sense looking at it from the outside, but when you grow up in it, you develop this way of this sort of magical way of looking at the world and thinking about it, and that definitely fed into my early writing. But the interesting thing is, I was discouraged by my parents and a lot of my Mormon readers or Mormon leaders from reading science fiction when I was younger, even though it seemed to feed into the same sorts of feelings that I got studying about the religion and so forth. And it was when I got into high school, I had been reading a lot of science fiction for a while, but started trying to write it, that I discovered Orson Scott Card, specifically a story collection of his that was in our high school library called Unaccompanied Sonata and Other Stories. And as I read the little author blurb on the back flap of the book jacket, and it said that he had spent 2 years as a missionary in Brazil, and then he lived in Utah, I started thinking, hey, this Card guy, he might be a Mormon too. So I guess it really is okay for a Mormon to write science fiction, and that was tremendously liberating to me. The one difficulty I had in those same years also was wrestling with the morality of writing stories that took place in future worlds that maybe conflicted with the picture of the future that I had been taught as a Mormon growing up. You know, if you believe that the Christ is going to have his second coming soon, is it really okay to write a story that's set maybe 500 years in the future where that didn't happen? Am I being honest to my own beliefs if I do that, or am I betraying them somehow? But I didn't let stuff like that really stop me. It just worried me.
Now, you actually brought these two worlds together not that long ago when you wrote science fiction set in the future with working LDS missionaries in it.
That's right. That was something that I had been wanting to do for a very long time. And I'd been working up to it for a while, really. One, working on the memoir and writing about actual missionaries. And two, I'd been writing a lot of science fiction that had religious themes. And finally, I just couldn't not do it anymore. And I was fairly sure this story would not have a lot of commercial potential, but I wrote a story set about 100 years in the future, 80 to 100 years in the future, that follows two Mormon missionaries on a space station at Lagrange Point 2, and how they are the first people to meet a new alien race and try to teach the aliens a discussion, more or less. One of the missionary lessons.
Which actually gets back to a comment you made very early in this interview where you described, to most people, LDS faith is kind of alien. And you kind of bring the subtext to text when you put the Mormons face to face with literal aliens.
I hadn't thought about it like that, really, but you're probably right. A pair of real fish out of water, right there, looking each other in the eye. I really did feel like an alien growing up. I figure that every teenager feels that way to some extent, and that's why a lot of us are drawn to science fiction, of course. But I didn't feel like just I was the alien, but as if my whole culture was some kind of alien entity trying to make its way in the larger heathen world.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I would hear about prominent Mormons in sports or in science fiction, like Orson Scott Card, I was very stunned that the rest of the world had even bothered to take notice of us strange people out in Utah. I had a real sense of dislocation from the culture at large, at the same time wanting very desperately to be accepted as a part of it.
Mm-hmm. So every time Dale Murphy hit a home run, the state of Utah kind of rose up and cheered.
Oh, yeah. State of Utah, yeah.
No, I want to talk about some of your other science fiction, because we kind of talked about how you can use the science fictional themes to illustrate issues of the day. And one of the ones of yours that I read in Salon a few years back that I really enjoyed was Love in the Age of Spyware. So tell us a little bit about that story. I loved that story.
This story, boy, it's one of a number of stories that I wrote first drafts of probably way back in the early 90s, and they sort of sat in a drawer. I didn't know quite what to do with them. They weren't quite working, but I wasn't willing to give up on them. And then suddenly, in the middle of 2003, I had an inspiration about this one story and how I could update it for our new internet and reality TV age. It's about a sort of an experiment in Los Angeles where seven people are chosen in a lottery to receive what are called spyware implants so that people can subscribe to a full sensory feed coming from each of these people and experience exactly what the person is experiencing as he or she goes through his daily life. And some of the seven are more popular than the others, and there are constant ratings showing, who's got the most subscribers, who's got the most people tuned in right at this very moment. That's just the background for the story. The story is actually about one of the seven who's having trouble in his marriage, and a robot that is run by the central Los Angeles computer is sort of escorting him home to where he's going to have an awful argument with his wife, and trying to explain to him this great vision of the future where everybody has spyware and civilization is much happier because of it. It's a story in part about our fascination with blogs and with reality programming and with really what I see as a technical voyeurism that we feed in our society. But it doesn't try to, at least in my mind, I'm not trying to condemn it wholesale, but trying to point out some of the things that are bad about it and some of the things that might be good about it if we could turn it to our advantage. That's what I was trying to do. I don't know if the story works that way, but that's the way I saw it.
Well, one of the things that's in there very subtly to me, and maybe I'm bringing my own baggage, you know, as a blogger and a podcaster to it, but there's a little hint of the supposition that in this kind of world, you know, where you're being watched and you're drawing an audience on it, that that's going to affect the choices you make, because you're going to do the things that draw the big numbers, right? You're not going to do your boring normal life when you know everyone's watching you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's something that's pretty evident when you watch reality TV, and that is in the story to a certain extent. Are people really behaving the way they would if there wasn't a camera following them around? It's like quantum physics in a way. The act of being observed changes the behavior of the subject. Does the fact that we could be watched more and more all the time, is that going to change the way that we behave as a culture? Probably. Mm-hmm. Probably going to have, it's already beginning to have immense changes on the way our culture acts and perceives itself, I think.
Now, I believe when you went to Clarion, you were taught by Damon Knight. Is that correct? Kate Wilhelm and Damon?
That is correct.
Have you ever read the Damon Knight story, I See You? That's the one where the kind of infotopia, he takes what should be a Big Brother premise that everyone can watch everybody else.
I've not read that story, no.
That's the one, actually, in the internet age and the world of privacy concerns, that's the one I come back to over and over again. Because it goes in such a, you know, Damon Knight being Damon Knight, it goes in such a counterintuitive direction. You know, mm-hmm. He said that his goal was to take what sounded like the most dystopic premise and make the most utopic story out of it. And but the what I always took out of it is that a lot of what we talk about as privacy is really about asymmetry, and that in an asymmetrical world, you know, we have these concerns, but in a symmetrical world where you can watch the people watching you, perhaps it's not so bad.
Yeah, that's a fascinating idea. I like Damon's approach in constructing that story. I think setting up the tension between dystopia and utopia is a really great strategy for inventing an interesting future. But more to the point, I think his insights there about privacy are right on. And this is something I'm actually dealing with in the novel I'm working on right now, which is an expanded version of my novella, Inclination. The society on the space station in that story, I've been writing a lot about space stations lately, I'm not sure why. The society is all based on citizens erecting different levels of privacy around what they do. And for instance, when the protagonist of the story, Jude, visits a little family unit that he's gotten to know, and he goes into their apartment to speak, they put him under nondisclosure, mm-hmm. Just by walking through the door, because this is a very private family, and they don't want any of their discussions leaked to the world at large, and they want to put Jude at ease that anything he says they will protect also. But that's not necessarily the norm in society as a whole. There's a lot of voyeurism and exhibitionism online in the society as a whole. But I think that goes to illustrate also something that's happening or that happens today. The online world is definitely not a monolithic entity in that not everybody wants to be exhibitionist or voyeuristic to the same extent. Some people really want to seem to live their entire lives in public on their blogs in excruciating detail, and that turns off a lot of readers and makes them uncomfortable, but other people just eat it up. And there are others who are a lot more careful or cagey about what they reveal in those online forums. But I think also the ones who tend to tell more tend to be younger, at least roughly, as far as I can tell. Perhaps the next generation is growing up with less concerns about exposing themselves online, mm-hmm. In a figurative sense.
Right. And so generationally, and that whole idea of the technology that was around when you came of age is just normal and part of the background, you kind of leads people to have different folk ways and different boundaries.
Exactly.
And so I was going to say that, you know, I have the same sort of situation in that some of my family members are bloggers and I blog about things and leak to them, link to them. And other people have explicitly opted out and don't ever want to be mentioned in it.
Right.
And it just sort of, a structure just sort of ad hoc builds up around the whole thing.
Right. Right. There's a lot of levels of etiquette to be worked out in these things also, which is interesting culturally and socially. I find often there are friends of mine who blog and whose blogs I don't necessarily follow regularly. When we meet up face-to-face in real life, often they start talking about things that they assume I should know mm-hmm. because they talk about it on their blog, and there's a bit of a disconnect there because I would rather get that sort of information and news in person in a lot of cases
mm-hmm.
and have it as sort of a private conversation rather than a public discussion.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about your life as a working writer. Now, in day life, you're very much like me. We've had very similar careers, and you know, we work in more or less the same field.
Mm-hmm.
And as when I was a teenager, I too thought the absolute dream life would be to be a working full-time writer. You know, what could be better? What could be more romantic? You know, you get up and you go to your typewriter, your Smith Corona, you know, at the time. And, you know, I had these visions of it. And I find that, you know, as time went on, for one thing, I guess more in an information age, I realized how and Jeannie actually had a lot to do this when I had first person access to working writers, and I realized how unromantic and how unsexy their day-to-day lives were, and that kind of fantasy went away, and I realized that in a large portion, you know, what I do, a lot of what I do as a computer programmer actually fills that same creativity role that I was hoping to fill with writing, and so I found that the older I got, the less urge I had to even, you know, sit down and bother. And so you kind of kept that urge alive, and you keep funneling your creativity into writing. But do you have that same sort of tension?
I do have that same tension. It is difficult. It takes a lot of work to keep writing momentum going when you've got an interesting day job, and one that is creative. There are times when I've got some huge project at work that's occupying all of my mind that I just can't write to save my life, because in all my off moments, my mind is completely filled up with whatever problem I'm trying to solve at the office, and there's just no getting it to think about any fiction in a way that you have to have your subconscious working in order to generate a good story. Having said that, I still look forward to the life of a full-time writer. I'm glad that I haven't been a full-time writer up to this point. I'm a pretty firm believer in the idea that you need to have lived, I don't mean to say have lived a full life or an interesting life, but you have to have lived a life in order to have something to write about. And I just think back and think, if I had by some miracle managed to become a full-time writer, like the moment I got out of college, I would not have all the interesting material I now have to write about. I still would have had, you know, my growing up years, and in a way, all of us write about our childhoods and in our writing, I think. But I've learned and experienced so much more because I've been a working computer programmer all these years. It hasn't just fed into the life experience that goes into my writing. It's fed in technically also, because I've had to stay up on computer developments and so forth. And that means that I can write with a certain amount of authority about some technical topics that help make the science fiction I write richer.
Now, one of the things too that kind of fed into my romance was, you know, Probably all this stuff was, you know, 40s, 50s era. You know, the idea that the writer moves to New York City and gets himself a cheap room, and he sells a short story a month, and that keeps the rent paid. You know, which financially hasn't been possible for, you know, what, 40 years or more. And so you kind of, as a way to keep your bills paid and your family fed, it seems like the fiction world has become less and less appealing over, say, the course of the last, 60, 70 years.
Absolutely. I do feel some nostalgia for those times that probably didn't even exist anymore by the time I was born, when you could be Kurt Vonnegut and keep your family in a nice house on Cape Cod, just writing short stories for the Saturday Evening Post. But I feel like I probably also romanticize that to some extent. Like there's this romantic ideal I have in my head of the writer who's just carrying his portable manual typewriter with him wherever he goes, ready to flip on his smoking jacket and fire up his pipe and crank out the wordage. And I still want to be that in some way, which is why, now with a job, I try to get up at 5 every morning, even on weekends, although I don't always succeed, and write for at least an hour before I start thinking about work and getting ready for work. I try to at least create some facsimile of that discipline that I've romanticized.
Mm-hmm. So as we kind of wind this up and to kind of wrap up some of the threads, you had mentioned early on that one of the things that happened from podcasting your work, mostly the novel, but also some of your stories, is that you got a different kind of interaction with and connection to your audience. Does that affect, the motivation that you have to do this, given that, you're not going to be able to quit your day job tomorrow based on the writing? Does that give you another reason to kind of get up at 5 and keep doing this?
Absolutely. It does. The most important thing it gives me is a reminder that there are people out there who want to hear this story, who are interested in hearing it. And that may be just the consequence of the fact that I was successful in promoting the idea of this vaporware memoir before it was ever written, which is sort of a science fictional concept in and of itself. But the fact that people are willing to tune in every 2 weeks and let me ramble in their ears for an hour while I read my book and explain everything that went into it, it helps me to stay focused and not give up on the prospect of selling the book eventually, because mm-hmm. I know that there's an audience for it out there.
Do you have concerns in this kind of a world without sort of legal precedent, that you're affecting the rights issue of selling the novel by having put it out in a different form?
I'm not extremely worried about that. I've thought about it, but I've also talked about this with folks like Cory Doctorow, who releases his novels all under a Creative Commons license online at the same time that they're physically published. I don't think that there's enough of an audience for the podcast that it should concern any publishers, and at least the editors that I've talked to seem to be on board with that also. It's not a big concern to them. Now, I could see how it would be if I had some kind of gigantic audience for my podcast, if 10,000 people or more were tuning in every couple of weeks, but the numbers aren't anything like that. So I don't think that I'm destroying a market. And when it comes to the rights for the book, if that ever became an issue, I would just try to get the publishers to quietly forget that I'd ever done a podcast.
I guess conceivably you could look at it a different way and say that, rather than kind of consuming the rights for it, it's actually validated the existence of a market.
Yes, exactly. And that's the way I've tried to spin it.
Well, very good. Well, I'm very glad that we finally got to talk, and I hope we do it again. There's so much that there's just not time to cover. been following your career since I read From Our Point of View, We Had Moved to the Left in, was that 1992? Was that when that?
1993.
Oh, wow. We were so young back then.
Yes, we were.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I've had a great time talking to you, and I hope also we can do it again.
That was our interview with author William Shun. He's currently republishing the audio version of his memoir, The Accidental Terrorist, which is available at his website, shun.net, shunn.net. Later this year, his collaboration with Daryl Murphy, Cast a Cold Eye, will be out from PS Publishing. Thank you for your time. Links associated with this conversation are available in the show notes at realitybreakpodcast.com. Comments and suggestions can be emailed to feedback@realitybreakpodcast.com. I'm your host, Dave Slusher, and I'll catch you again when we meet back here for the next Reality Break. I need to take